Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Tao Lin. His newest book is the novel Taipei. It's published by Vintage. Tao Lin is a writer who has been inspiring controversy. People have described him and his writing as autistic. They've named him the Ritalin Kid. He's everywhere on the web. You can't tweet without knowing him. And people have gotten infuriated. Personally, I find his writing beautiful, haunting, moving, careful, and that of all the writing I've read by younger writers, he's in his early 30s, I find it to be the most moving depiction of the way we live now, by which I mean it has become hard for people to talk to one another, and Tao Lin has developed the ability within his books to describe that difficulty, not talking, but how we do not talk, not moving one another, but how we try to. And I find it to be inutterably moving. Now, Tao, you've mentioned about this book that this is the one where the themes of the book are balanced most carefully, and that it's hard to talk about the book because everything is held in equilibrium. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. It seems like a novel of ideas because there's many ideas in it, but to my view, it's not a novel of ideas. It's just that the main character has many ideas. And he thinks up these ideas to primarily to console himself or to stimulate himself.
And because he's always thinking, people find him withdrawn. And he is, because he's becoming lost, he's like someone who has spent his life looking for a mirror that will reflect him accurately, but that mirror somehow stopped existing at a certain point, and he has theories instead about his existence, what he might be. Do you think this is typical of more than just this character? Because I think in a sense it defines a generation.
I wouldn't say it's generational, but I think it's a common way of people living their lives, which is trying to get into the imagination, escaping physical laws of reality.
You were emailing, blogging, eventually tweeting to let people know about your work. You began publishing in your 20s. This is including short stories, other novels. This is your sixth book that I know, yes?
Yes.
And it seems to me to be not only your best, but the one where a reader could come in and say, oh, I see. He's authentic. He's what he says he is. Now, I wanted to begin by asking you to read a section of the book when the book begins to feel like a romance. The main character, Paul, has seen several women. His favorite so far has been Michelle, but all of them fade off. Usually because I think other novels, I'm thinking of Richard Yates's great novel of marriage, Revolutionary Road, will spend a whole book watching a marriage disintegrate. In Taipei, disintegration is constant. It might be daily, weekly, monthly, but it's ongoing. And so this is writing that's charting constant disintegration. And there's this woman, Erin, who shows up on Paul the Hero's book tour, and she seems to be just around. It's easy for her to be there, and they begin to notice that this is something of a pleasure. And I'm going to ask you to read a passage that I think of as a very romantic passage. This is a section of Taipei by my guest, Tao Lin. In it, Paul and Erin are leaving the place where they are feeling uncomfortable because they've taken mushrooms and the other people there haven't, and they're becoming too self-conscious, and Paul says he wants to walk alone with Erin.
Both were outside the room in a dark hallway where they huddled together and maneuvered, grinning, to winding stairs, which they descended holding hands towards the front door. They walked down the driveway into the upper middle class neighborhood with their inside arms folded up and against each other. Most front yards had one or two fashionably sculpted trees and two or more colorful Boy Scouts-like patches of flowers and plants in an independent organization. Paul saw in a side yard a pale fence with the colorless, palatially melancholy glow of unicorns, and remembered how in Florida, in the second of his family's three houses of increasing size, both his neighbors had built fences, rows of vertical triangular top slats of wood that had seemed huge, medieval, around their backyards. Paul said he felt like he was in Edward Scissorhands, and they sat on a concrete embankment facing the street with their feet on a sidewalk. Paul slightly looked away as he said, "There's so many stars here," without much interest. Erin pointed and asked if one was moving. "In place, maybe," said Paul uncertainly. "It looks like it's vibrating," said Erin. It's what thoughts do you have about UFOs?" said Paul, looking away, as if not wanting Erin to hear him clearly. "I'm doing it. I'm saying stereotypical things that people say while on mushrooms." "That's okay. UFOs are interesting." "I know it's okay," said Paul, and asked if Erin had experienced, quote, any UFO things. Erin said she wore purple and put glitter on her eyes every Friday in fourth grade because she thought if she did, aliens would notice and take her away. "That seems really good," said Paul, feeling emotional. "All purple?" "No, it just had to be one thing that was purple." "Where did you think they would take you?" "I don't think I thought about that," said Erin. "Just away, anywhere." "What did your classmates or other people think?" "I've never told anyone." "Really? But it's been so long." "I didn't have anyone to tell, really." "You haven't told anyone except me?" "No, let me think. No, I haven't." Paul had begun to vaguely feel that he already knew of a similar thing. Something about purple glitter in fourth grade. Maybe from a children's book. Or was he remembering what he just heard? His voice sounded bored, he thought, as he told Erin about when, as a fourth or fifth grader, he really wanted to see a UFO and was on a plane and saw a brown dot, and, without any excitement or sensation of discovery, repeatedly thought to himself that he'd seen a UFO. "I think I was aware at first that I was faking it," said Paul uncertainly, "but I think I convinced myself so hard that I made myself forget that part. When I was aware, and I think I really believed I saw a UFO." "Whoa, did you tell anyone you saw a UFO?" "I don't think I ever told anyone. I don't think I cared if anyone knew. I was just like, I saw a UFO. I think I was extremely bored. I was like a bored robot.
Tao Lin, reading from Taipei. Now, if I can talk to you about that, it makes me cry, and then we learn, in fact, this is something that she did read in a children's book. She's making it up, and she has told other people before, so that what's emotionally and sentimentally moving about it is also its falsehood, that people lie in order to connect to one another. It's one of the things that is the way you see into these characters, yes?
She admits that she has told someone it before, but I don't think it's clear if she has actually read it in a children's book yet.
But nevertheless, it tempers the moment as we originally witnessed it, and these characters are constantly evolving because they're always testing one another.
Yeah, and Paul later thinks he tries to put himself in Aaron's position, and he thinks that he probably would have lied in that situation also. And he thinks Aaron just said she hadn't told anyone just because she thought she wouldn't see Paul again. He'd just be another person who she wouldn't talk to.
That he'd drift away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, you say that it's not romantic. What do you call it?
I call it a high level of equilibrium. Or just the reciprocation, the amount of attraction is equal or close to equal.
So is that why it's not terrifying? Because there's a balance?
Because there's the sense that it's just simply the sense that you're less alone if two people are attracted to the same degree. Because that would mean that if it was exactly the same attraction between two things, like a planet and a star, that would result in the planet going into the star. So that's what they are intuiting, and that's what makes their relationship fun and pleasurable, I think.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating because it does feel that there's like an astrophysics of relationships going on here, largely because Paul is thinking all the time, and it's as if his experience is like an experiment that he's testing his hypotheses on. And it's a yearning. I don't think he knows how sad he is and how much his thoughts are providing him with consolation for a kind of relentless feeling of alienation.
I don't think he even would ever articulate any of the thoughts that are in the book, but he intuits them.
Yes, and that's what makes the book full of silence. This kind of silence between people who are together and have come to know one another seems to me to be very difficult to do, to write inarticulateness, to write incomprehension, to write about thought just as it's going out of control and beyond one's ability to say. If someone were to ask, what are you thinking? You wouldn't be able to say so. How do you manage to do that in writing? What is your process like?
I'll just have the character say, I don't know. And then in this book, I would think, put myself in the position of a person who said, I don't know, and think really hard about what they would say if they had like a day to articulate it. And then that would go into the, that would be the author stating that.
Oh, so that really is true. I mean, it, as a result, has an incredible density. Like they're summarizing what they wouldn't be able to say to begin with and would take them hours to come up with.
And they would never even have a reason to study what they actually felt or thought.
Yes. That gives a certain tragic feeling to the writing. Do you feel it that way?
I don't, because I got the opportunity to think on these things and express them in the book. And everyone can have that opportunity.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Tao Lin about his book, Taipei. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tao Lin about his new book, Taipei, published by Vintage. It's an examination of contemporary life through the eyes of a young New York writer who feels perhaps deeper thoughts than he's capable of articulating, and the sadness of the loss of clarity is part of the great sadness of the book. I think when you hear this next section, you'll see how these relationships disintegrate into a place that is replaced by petting. Given that you've heard the sweet part of Aaron and Paul's early relationship, I thought it would be interesting to hear this section from toward the end of Tao Lin's Taipei.
The effort became gradually smaller and more unconscious, and as if for something to do, in place of what was now automatic, Paul began to discern his rhythmic petting as a continuous striving to elicit certain information from Aaron by responding or not responding to her rhythms, in a cycle whose goal was to produce momentary equilibriums. He felt increasingly attuned to the speed and quality of her breathing and heart rate, until he felt able to instantly discern changes in her physiology, which in entirety began to seem like an inconstant unit of unique, irreducible information, an ever-changing display of only prime numbers, that was continuously expressed and that bypassed the parts of them that allowed for deliberation or perception or intuition, beginning and ending in the only place where they were exactly together, undifferentiated and unknowable, but couldn't, in their present form, ever reach, like a thing communicating directly with itself, rendering them both irrelevant. Paul began to sometimes laugh uncontrollably, with his face at the back of Aaron's neck, unsure what was funny. When he saw her frowning a few minutes later, she burrowed her head against his chest, and he said, "What are you thinking about?" And she didn't answer, and in an increasingly incredulous voice, like he mostly wanted to express how amazingly difficult it was to know, sometimes pausing after each word for emphasis, he repeatedly stated a question. "This isn't what I expected at all," he heard himself say at some point, without knowing what he was referencing. He'd obviously wanted something good to happen, but what was happening wasn't expected, based on what he'd said. Therefore, it must be bad. He was yawning, so was factually bored of Aaron. "I feel like I can't breathe," he said, and suddenly stood and felt confused and unreal. He repeatedly fell onto his mattress, which every time seemed much less substantial than expected, dropping his body with increasing force and desperation, then lay on his back, unsatisfied and worried. Sleeping, waking, he said frustratedly. Is there a difference? Am I dead? You're not dead, said Aaron. I think I'm dead, said Paul distractedly, and covered his face with a blanket.
Well, a section from toward the end, the last 10 pages of Tao Lin's Taipei. But literature is salvation here.
Yeah, because literature is imagination. And these people, or Paul, wants to believe that death releases us from reality into imagination. So the characters in a book, like imagine you were a character in a book, you would think you're real. You would never think that there's someone reading about you and say if you suffered the equivalent of dying, you could be released into what we have now. And we can't imagine being released into a higher dimension. But that's what he would like to believe, that dying releases us into imagination.
Well, that's one of the things that I think that people haven't realized. It seems to me that your work is metaphysical and philosophical. Well, those two are the same, metaphysical and philosophical. And that there is a profound request for relief or release from life, from thought, from consciousness, and that somehow the experience of the imagination is seen somehow as boundless. Do you trust the imagination?
I view it as we all exist in reality, which has its laws of cause and effect, linear time. And we all also exist at the same time in the world of imagination, which has different laws. I don't know what they are. But there's no cause and effect, for example. Like, I can think of the Earth flying around in my imagination. But that can't happen in reality.
And yet they're simultaneous.
Yeah.
They intermesh, they braid with one another. And the yearning, I think, of fiction itself is to provide a simulacrum of the imagination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the universe itself also has a yearning to return to imagination, just by the existence of gravity. Because gravity, eventually everything is going to attract each other and become one thing. And at that point, it seems like it will just be imagination.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting to me, because one of the things you mention in Taipei, the novel by my guest Tao Lin, is that there's a book called The End of Science. And it speculates that the end, the destiny of everything, is more technology until everything becomes part of the universe of the computer.
Yeah.
I have the feeling that although Paul in the book thinks of that as a point of unity,
yeah,
that the book in fact is struggling in the opposite direction to enter the unity of imagination, where everything is fused in the dimension of melded and universal possibility.
Well, don't you think they're the same? If you just have one computer that's everything, that would be just the human effort to only exist in imagination. Like, technology could be viewed as the human effort to escape concrete reality and move into imagination.
That's interesting. I never thought of that. I think the reason I never thought of that is that I'm 61 and I'm still scared of technology. It's just a habit that literary people developed. It seems to me that you aren't. From the very beginning of anyone knowing Tao Lin, you're blogging, eventually you're tweeting, you're communicating about yourself in the virtual realm. Do you feel safe there?
I do. Paul in the book, I think throughout most of it, he has aversion towards technology because he views technology as moving only in one direction and building upon itself for the sole purpose of being better able to build more of itself. In contrast to, say, the natural world with the seasons cycling. And it's only in that one moment in the book where he remembers that in high school, he felt consoled by the idea that one day we might all just be one computer. And I don't think he even thought about why, he just intuited that. So in the short term, throughout most of the book, Paul doesn't like what's happening with technology. But in that one moment, he sees, like, billions of years in the future, maybe this technology is the only way to get back to a oneness.
An undifferentiated reality.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. I mean, fascinating and difficult. And could you imagine writing a book that would describe the condition of that undifferentiation?
No, because I think by definition, it's unimaginable.
I've been speaking with Tao Lin, author most recently of Taipei, published by Vintage. Thank you, Tao, for joining me.
Thank you for having me. That was fun.
It was a real pleasure. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Taipei at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Linda Spaulding is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.